several years ago when I cleaned these floors in this room. And I remember cleaning the floors and wiping off the cabinets and being back there in the bookshelves and being so grateful to be here at Concordia Seminary. Back in right at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s, this was the place I cleaned up. This was how I earned my living, by dusting the shelves and washing the windows in the front and sweeping the leaves from those two trees right there by the fountain would start shedding. I once wrote a poem about me and God having a kind of a gentle war. Him putting leaves down there and me sweeping them up. And then mine the leaves at the same time. And then feeling a kind of resentment that they were falling because I had to clean them up. So it was a real big bunch of emotions. But at the same time, again, happy that I was at Concordia Seminary because it was my job. The way I came here, I came to Concordia Seminary via Birmingham, Alabama. And that's where I was born. I was born to Dorothy and Otis Woodard in 1936. And at about 5 years old, Dorothy Woodard, when I was born, was 10 years old. And my father was 31. And they lived to kind of life of blacks who had been in touch with slavery and whose grandparents had lived with Indians in the South. So it was kind of a real mixed bag of traditions and customs in my family. And my grandmother and grandfather on my mother's side, who helped to choose my father, chose him because he was strong and because he had a little gray hair and because they liked the way he looked and they thought that he could handle my mother, who was quite something to handle at 10 years old. And he married her, and I was born when she was still 10 years old. By the time I was born, she was still 10 and he was 31. Which they stayed married until he died just about a year ago. He was a real strong father, and he was really one of my heroes even now, he's one of my greatest heroes, because he was the first black guy who I saw who voted in my neighborhood. My dad was so persistent about voting that my dad wanted to vote so bad, and I never understood it when I was small, how come he was so anxious about voting. And he was so poor. He made $15 a week, and he worked as a bellman at a hotel at night. And even when I started throwing newspapers, I made more than he did. But Dad stayed at that job, making this $15 plus a handful of tips. But my dad was so insistent about trying to vote, and he would go down to the city hall. He would pay his poll tax in Birmingham, Alabama, and he would always pass his written test, but he would always fail his oral test. And what he would do when he would go down there, my dad would go down there, but he'd remember all the questions they'd asked him, and he'd remember the ones he'd missed, and he'd study, and then before he'd go to try the next time, he would have all of us who were old enough to get around him and give him a test. And we'd ask him the questions that he had been asked before, so he'd be shocked. And so I remember asking him questions like, how many trees were there in the square block of the courthouse? My dad knew. How many fireplugs were there in the square block of the courthouse? My daddy knew that. How many steps were there leading up to the front of the courthouse? My dad knew the answer to that question. How many windows were there in the courthouse? My daddy knew. How many offices that were in the courthouse? These are actual questions because I remember them. And I know the answers myself. How many offices there were? My daddy knew that. The last question my dad missed before he was allowed to vote, they asked him how many white women's restrooms there were in the courthouse. And he said that the guy actually kind of, he said the guy kind of chuckled when he asked him the question. And my dad said they were probably searching for questions. He knew all the trivia. My dad knew more courthouse trivia than you could ever name. He would have been a master at courthouse trivia pursuit at Birmingham. But my dad knew all the answers. And when my dad received a letter that acknowledged that he was now a registered voter in Birmingham, it was one of the greatest moments in my house. I remember his look and his intensity for that. And I mean, when he would get ready to vote, we'd all go in there and help him dress. And then I'd run out to the front porch in my poor neighborhood and wait for my dad to walk out so I could see my friends and look at him in envy, knowing that my dad was the only guy in my neighborhood who was voting. And we thought voting was big. And I thought black people, and as people in the world, he said you should vote. That's how come I thought voting was very important. It influenced my growing up, and it influences me now. The other thing that influenced me was one day my mother decided, every Sunday my mother would make me go out and go to a church. My family were all Baptists. It was the only church my family ever knew. But my mother didn't direct me at the Baptist church. She just would put me out of the house in the morning at every Sunday morning. I realize now that since I've been mature that was a little method to all of that. Since my dad worked at night, and the only time my mother could be with him in private in our three-room house was in the morning time, it looked like it was almost for convenience that they'd throw me out in the morning on Sunday. But I would go out, but I thought it was for very different reasons when I was little. I said, she doesn't want me to be a religious guy, so I would go to all the churches in the neighborhood. The Catholic Church kind of confused me because it was in Latin, and I was a little boy, 5 years old. I didn't understand Latin, and I didn't know when to stand, when to sit, when to get on my knees. I didn't understand that. I was scared in the Baptist church because sometimes during the service, there would be all of a sudden somebody around me would explode and scream. And I thought I was going to get trampled one day by accident. So I said, I was a little guy, so I had to be very careful. I didn't want to get hurt. And I went around to the different churches. But one day, I was passing a house in Birmingham, Alabama, on 6th Avenue. And I heard music coming from the basement. And I was thinking to myself, I had thought I had hit every church in that neighborhood. But there was one church I thought I might have missed because it was in the basement of the house. I wanted to check it out. And so I didn't intend to go in. I wanted to first peep in there. And I kind of tiptoed down the steps of that little house and accidentally stumbled at the bottom step. So I really committed myself right in front of the door before I could stop myself. So the door was open, and I just stumbled right in front of the door. Well, when I looked in there, the most amazing sight that one could ever see, there was a man in the front, and you could tell he was a preacher. There was a lady on the piano. And you could tell that she was the mother of the only two people in the congregation. They were sitting there, and this guy was having a service right out of the old blue book on page 5. I mean, like, 10,000 people there. I mean, he was having a service with the music, liturgy, everything. I looked at him real carefully, and they just moved another little chair beside their two kids' chair, and I just kind of eased in the side and sat down and watched this guy. And, you know, the music, I'm a black guy. Birmingham, Alabama. I even played in jazz bands. I played trombone in jazz bands, trombone, baritone. My family kind of grew out of jazz. My uncle, who was in Ringling Brothers Circles, was billed as the world's greatest accordionist, but he was a jazz guy. In my family, you know, the rhythms in my family were boom, de boom, boom, de boom. We listened at the music of that liturgy downstairs in that basement. I was sitting there listening at it, and you know, that German music go everywhere. And I was sitting there going, whoa, listen to this. I was ready till now. I've gotten to understand the beautiful meaning of the liturgy. It's very personal and wonderful to me what it's done in the liturgy for me and the confession and all of that. But then he got to a part that a five-year-old could understand. And during the early 1940s, when I was a little kid, 1940-41, when I stumbled into the Lutheran church by accident, this guy had a revolutionary message. This guy who came from Concordia Seminary, that mystical place called Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. He stood there looking down at me and these other two kids, and he said, you are special people. He said, you are so special that God sent his son here to die for you. I was going, me? Otis Woodard? I was looking around to see what this goodest dude was talking to. I said, he can't be talking about a little black guy in Birmingham, Alabama, who couldn't afford shoes some days, and who some days would go anywhere without a shirt because nobody was saying anything about saying to a five-year-old black guy. It was hot, and he didn't have a shirt, or it was just too hot to wear a shirt. And this guy had such a strong message that I knew he was talking to me. He said, you are special and set apart. And I thought that message was so big and powerful that I wanted to tell my sister about it. She was in kindergarten. She was at home. I went back home, and I said, you got to come and see this church. A strange church with nobody attends it. I said, you got to come and see it. And I got all of my friends who were in kindergarten with me and all of my friends who I played with around that neighborhood to come back no problem. He just pulled up a few extra seats. Did a whole service out of pay 15. Communion and all. And nobody could take communion but him and his wife. Stick it to the stick. Just hammering it out. He's hammering it out. I mean, as if he was preaching to 1 million people. Here's this pastor in this little basement, no Lutheran sign even in front of his house. Preaching sermons as if he's preaching at that Chapel of the Cross or some other big church. This guy's hammering it. And we were saying that totally fascinated with it. He took up communion, and we didn't have money. I mean, he took up a collection. I mean, he passed the plate as if he was going to get some money from us. We didn't have no money. God didn't care. He passed the plate anyway. I was sure he would pass the plate before we came there. This guy was just set. Just, he was hammering out. But the one place where he would catch us all was his preaching of the gospel that talked about us. All of us, little, poor, black kids who live in the southern part of the city in Birmingham, Alabama. And I was so impressed by this guy that I kept bringing my friends to hear him. We filled that basement up to finally it happened. We ran out of chairs. It was filled with little bitty little kids who were sitting there dirty and chewing bubblegum, passing candy. And nobody to stop us. No urges, no nothing to stop us. We call it our church. My mother got interested in this group of kids congregating on our porch every Sunday morning to meet him. We'd tell her little stories about what was happening there, about him running out of hymnals, running out of Bibles. And she said she was interested enough to come to check us out. And my mother followed me into that church one day, followed us. And she looked at the church overflowing with little kids. And the pastor had a dilemma. He didn't have no more chairs and no more hymnals, no more Bibles. And he said they should write off and maybe write to those folks in Missouri Synod about our church so that we could get some help. Look, we needed some chairs. That's what we were looking for. Well, they sent some guys down there to look at our strange little congregation. And they had said to the pastor that if he could baptize enough of us, they would consider giving them a loan to build a church. Some of the older people here probably know about my church, St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Birmingham, Alabama, that lists me as one of the founders of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Birmingham. I was the first Lutheran in my family. Now, all the members of my family are Lutheran in my immediate family. And everyone I know is a Lutheran. And we've all been an active part of the church. As a matter of fact, they have my name as a founder of two Lutheran churches in the South. I got so fond of the pastors who came there that I looked at a pastor one day. He was my hero. As far as I consider, anyone who could come in my neighborhood and preach the gospel in the conditions that he preached them in. And this one guy, Pastor Elwanger, who was one of the guys who was a pastor at that church. His father was also active down at Selma Academy down in Alabama. Well, during those times. This was a revolutionary time for us in the church. Well, we were so scared for this one pastor. We had a succession of pastors, but the one pastor I was so scared about lived alone. He would be at that church in the day. He was the only white man who lived in my neighborhood, in that house that was above that church, and next to that church eventually. And he would be by himself, and I would go. He wouldn't let us even have Walter Lead meetings at night. Anytime night fell, he would shut everything down at the church so that if anybody would blow up the church, none of his parish members would be hurt. And we used to get at home and call to the church to see was he okay when we have long absences away from him, because he was a man by himself there just to preach the gospel to all of us, to keep us inspired and give us a message about power, almost a revolutionary message. Hearing when black people were sitting on the back of buses, not allowed to eat in restaurants, and even the Lutheran churches in Birmingham, Alabama. I didn't even know there were other Lutheran churches. I did years later that there were other Lutheran churches where black people just couldn't go. Well, but that church right there was doing what it does, and it was doing it the best. I decided that when I was a young teenager, I wanted to be like my pastor. I wanted to be a Lutheran preacher. I really wanted to be. I became an elder when I was near 10 years old. Because I'm one of the oldest people in my congregation. So they made me an elder. tell you, when they baptized all of us, it had to be the most spectacular sight of this pastor baptizing the first Lutherans in my neighborhood. All of us little starry-eyed black kids standing there with this pastor baptizing us in a way that we had never been baptized before, and giving us what we felt was real power and making us a part of a family that was indestructible and big. We never felt that family relationship and that kind of... He told us that we'd be a part of a big family, and that's what we did. We got baptized to come into a big family of Christians. And so after that happened, I had decided I wanted to be a Lutheran pastor, so I sent off a letter to a strange place for me then. It was called Concordia Seminary, and it was in St. Louis, Missouri. And I wrote this letter with all the kind of dreamy ideas of a kid that was 14 years old. And I said that I thought that I wanted to be the guy who brought the message to communities like mine, who would go out there and tell people Jesus loved them, that he cared about them, that they were part of a big family. I wanted to give them the gospel that told them that they were special and set apart people when they became part of God's family. And so I wrote this letter off and asked what it would take for me to get in Concordia Seminary. And they sent me back a big brown envelope. It had all that stuff in there, you know. I opened it up and it talked about tuition and college credits and all that stuff. I was thinking about my family. I said, I'll never get there because we were so poor. And then they also did something else. Now, you've got to know that it's right at the end of the 40s, right at the end of 1950. I'm still in Birmingham, Alabama. Things are still very intense there for black people. They sent me also two pictures of graduating classes, of past graduating classes of Concordia Seminary. I guess that's one thing they just do is put two pictures in there so I could see the kind of folks at Concordia Seminary. And being a guy, a black guy, living in Birmingham, Alabama in the 50s, I was really very interested in the pictures. I looked in there very carefully. And I didn't see me in there nowhere. I decided, I said, well, maybe. I mean, this would be probably two wrong pictures. I look at it. Since I've been in this school, I've seen many black guys. I know many black guys who graduated. Some of them are my good friends right now. But I decided maybe that wasn't for me. And maybe I could probably let people know that I was part of this big world in some other way. So I decided if I couldn't become a Lutheran pastor, I'd become the next tough thing you could be. I became a United States Marine. So I figured if you really want to see something tough, you see a Lutheran pastor. That is tough. Anybody think that's not tough, dramatic, exciting stuff? I've lived near them, and I've seen what they have to do, and that's tough. I became a United States Marine. But my church kept pulling at my shirt tail. Everywhere I go, I still get bulletins from churches that I worship at all over the United States. Church bulletins from those churches who really consider me part of them. I remember going off to service, and then I remember coming to North Carolina, the box. I was stationed in Rodman Canal Zone down in Panama, Central America for about 9 years of my service. But I would come back to the United States to box because I was a good boxer. And they'd bring me back to Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. And then I would go to boxing in Norfolk, Virginia and around Wilmington. And when I would box, I would be there for a while, so I would have to worship. I would try to look for a church to worship at. Well, one of those churches around near Charlotte, North Carolina, decided that they were going to really let me worship at that service. You've got to know, finding a church for a black Lutheran was tough. I would look at other blacks. They said, what church you belong to? I said, Lutheran. They said, do you worship God? You bet. But I was invited to a church of folks and who let me in that church. They not only let me in that congregation, but they let me join that choir. And so anytime I was in North Carolina, I could go to that one church. No other blacks were there. They invited me in there because I looked for a church to worship at to take communion at. And I guess that's how my appreciation of the Lutheran church is really, really deep, because some of the instances where I looked to be with my Lutheran family on Sunday mornings have been interesting as I went across the United States. Some of them have been hair-raising, and some of them have had really great rewards. As, for in Meridian, Mississippi, when I went to worship with a pastor, Shindehetti. I never will forget, I looked in the Yellow Pages when I was doing civil rights work to see if that was a Lutheran church so I can go and get communion. My pastor in Birmingham said, you got to get communion. And I would look for a church to get communion at. He thought that I better keep close to my church, and he always made sure I was reminded to do that. Well, I looked in the Yellow Pages and saw one Lutheran church in Meridian, Mississippi. And so I decided I better call, see if there's an opportunity for me to even get close to that church. So I called the pastor in the morning. They had a telephone number on the recorder, and I called him. And I said, listen, I said, I don't want to come into your church. I don't want to disturb your service. I know that you probably don't have any black Lutherans attending. I said, but can I stand outside of your church and listen at the church service? And then after it's all over, you can invite me maybe inside and give me communion. He said, he thought I heard the silence on the phone. He said, Otis Woodard, if you showed up at our church and somebody caught you around, they'd probably hang you above the pulpit. And he wasn't being mean. He said, we never had this problem before. He said, but I'll tell you what I'll do. After church service, I'll come to your house and give you communion. And so Pastor Shindehetti started coming to my house practically every Sunday after church service to give me communion. And he would have a little Bible study with me. We'd sit down. And I started to invite other people to join me at the house. Because I say other people during church, I'm just one around the street. I felt I wanted to be in a group of folks. I would tell the folks, come on in with me. The pastor's going to come over here, and we're going to study the Bible, say a hymn or two. And the crowd started gathering, and it kept growing and growing and growing. And finally, it reached 300. I'm real serious. Pastor Shindehead had called Pastor Elwanger down at Selma Academy and said, you got to send us up and help. These people were all crowding in my little two-room house and sitting all on the porch and on the street to hear the gospel from this guy who was coming out the church to bring it to us. And that crowd kept growing and growing. They went to bring in students from Selma Academy up to Meridian, Mississippi to handle that group. There was a whole new church started there. The pastor, Shindehead, was in a dilemma. He started at first sneaking out a few hymnals and a few Bibles out of the church. And then he would put in his trunk of his car, he'd sneak a few chairs because it kept getting bigger. And he finally went to stealing benches. And he said, Otis, they're going to catch me because I'm taking every hymnal out of church. This place has gotten bigger than my congregation. I mean, the church just, it grew right around. Some lady who I met at a Southern Illinois convention told me that she worshipped in that very church that was started there. They called it the First Mission Among Negroes there in Meridian, Mississippi. I was so pleased that that happened. Looked like God gave me adversity just so that that could happen. But then other things happened as I went down back to the South after 11 years in the Marine Corps to see what a tough Christian could do out there in the world, where there were tough things still happening to people. And because my love for the right to vote was still there in my heart, planted by my father, I went back to Mississippi and joined the Civil Rights Movement. And I worked with CORE, and I worked with SNCC because I was a Christian. And I thought that Christians needed to be in the middle of the action. I figured if you can't be a preacher, then put your arms and legs to work. Make something happen. And I worked in Mississippi, and I went to jails in Mississippi. I got beat up in Mississippi. I had a car explode while I was in it in Mississippi. I met guys like Charles Evers. I got to be close to Dr. Martin Luther King and all those other folks that were doing dramatic things around Mississippi and Clarksdale through the Delta. I knocked on doors and went on plantations and really learned that voting was really must have been important because there were so many people fighting people who were trying to get the right to vote. Finally, I went to Memphis, Tennessee to let my heels cool, to let things cool off around me. They voted that I should go there because if I would go to a restaurant, the health department would close it down. If I was seen talking to another black person, that person might lose their job. And we had built up a coalition of people, white and black, and they called it the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And it became, and those people who are older, who saw the Democratic Convention in the 60s, where all those people were, there were two delegations sent from Mississippi, one the regular Democratic Party, one the Freedom Democratic Party. Democratic Party. And right there in front of national TV, these two groups shuffling said, we have the right for the seats to be seated at this Democratic convention. And our group won. Our group was voted to be the group that was going to be seated in that convention. And from then on, the politics in Mississippi were to change. But the violence kept going. And I decided to let myself go to Memphis, Tennessee, and let everything cool off. And I met my wife, Gladys. The reason I mentioned her, because she was a part of the seminary also. After I stayed in Memphis, Tennessee for a while, the garbage strike came. And again, it was hard to stay back and keep myself out of the action, to be around Dr. King, to be around those folks in Tennessee dealing with that garbage strike. And one day in April, in the 60s, I was standing on a motel balcony looking into a room where Dr. Martin Luther King was meeting. And all I was just almost the guy who was there as a utility man that took the signs to get people back and forth, to direct people to the church on Hernando where Dr. Martin Luther King was going to speak that night. And my wife was pregnant with a son that was going to be born right close to this campus. And we were there, and I left that balcony, and when I got home, I had heard kind of stuff off the balcony, and Dr. King stepped out there to break for lunch. He had got shot. And from then on, my life really changed. I was standing on the porch of the house crying after that event, after hearing getting a call from the motel that Dr. King had been killed. And then I heard a loud noise. My wife was still in the house, and she left me out there so I could cry in private. And I heard this loud noise, and the rumbling came up the street. And I knew I had been in the military. I knew what it sounded like, but I didn't want to believe that what it was. It was a tank, a big tank with a guy standing at a turn of a machine gun on the top of it, come rumbling down Carpenter Street and turn suddenly in front of my house, roll over the hedges, and stop within inches of my doorstep. And I stood there just paralyzed at the sight of this thing just glooming down in my little three-room house. My wife and the two kids that I had were brought out on the porch. She stood out of my little kids holding her hand. And I would still be, I'd still be standing there today if she hadn't whispered in my ear, should I bring the shotgun? I thought that was the funniest thing. My wife was going to get a shotgun to have a firefight with this tank. I mean, she honestly thought that I should react to it. And in my anger and in my sadness, that was this big joke. I thought about it. I just turned and put my arms around my wife and led her back in the house with our kids. And in the next few weeks, the few months, I found it a scary place to stay because I heard that somebody was going to try to kill the baby that my wife was pregnant with in Memphis. And so saving the last few little money I had, I looked at a map to see where I could come to be, get out of the way and hide for a little bit. And the biggest city I found in Memphis on the map was St. Louis. I never lived up north. I was kind of scared of north, but I figured they won't expect me to go north, but I'm a southerner, see? I said, but I was slipping to St. Louis and just slipped in the middle of all them people and disappeared. And so in the middle of the night, I got on a bus and I came up here. Got off the bus and walked toward the middle of the city and ended up on Cobriant Avenue right near Dr. King around that area. And we slept on a few people's front porch. And then we found a vacant house to sleep in down on Cousins Avenue. I didn't know anybody. I just wanted my wife to have a baby safe. That's all I wanted. And then I was going to get out of this city. But walking around this city for the first few days was really an interesting thing because I learned that there were people all over this place without food and other people who were not just traveling through the city who didn't have a place to stay. And after the fifth day of my involuntary fast, I had said that if I ever be able to feed my own family here in this big city, whatever else I could hustle, I would share with other folks who I was out on the street with. Well, the one miracle that happened on a Sunday morning for me was that I was decided that if everything was normal, I would have been in my Lutheran church. I would have been in my church, and I would have been worshiping with my family. And I felt I needed them. But I didn't know where they were. And, you know, because I came down from the South, I figured that all cities had one Lutheran church or two. So I walked to the telephone directory out of a phone booth, and I opened it up, the yellow pages up to Lutheran. I went, whoa! 1 million Lutheran churches! I've never seen that many Lutheran churches. I decided that I would use the last coins we had to ask the church to pray for us. And I didn't have one specific church in mind. I just looked at all the churches, and I dropped a coin in the telephone, and I dialed a church, and a guy picked it up. And I heard the church, the music in the background. And I said, I said, I'm homeless, and I don't have a job, and I want you to pray for all people who are homeless and don't have work. That's all I said. He said, well, who are you? I said, that's not important. I said, pray for all of us. That includes me and my family. He said, well, I tell you what. He said, I am getting ready to march in. I'm playing the processional right now. You could hear it in the background. He said, but if you could tell me or give me a telephone number, maybe I can call you back and get you a job. And I stayed at the telephone booth, and I waited. And after service, the telephone rang. And he said, we have a job, sir. I'm a professor at Concordia Seminary. And he said, there's a job that may be open. And he said, if you can get out here tomorrow morning, which would be Monday, he said, I might could get you on as a janitor. I said, Concordia Seminary? And so I got my wife into the basement of a church down in Martin Luther King and Grand. And I walked up toward, I got to the restroom as best as I could and walked up through the Forest Park. I kept getting lost in Forest Park. Every time I would walk toward that end of the city, it looked like Forest Park covered the whole top end of the city. But I found my way to Concordia Seminary and I got a job. I had talked to a professor, Wunderlich, who was a professor here at the seminary. And it was really wild. I mean, it was great. When I got here, I mean, I hardly remember the tough days that I had because I had to wait on a paycheck to get, before I got my first food here. I had to look for food still. I didn't want to bother folks to tell them I was telling my plight or to bother them. So I just kept quiet. And I would go up here, up at the top of these steps, and I'd watch those windows, and I'd look at people out there. One day, I saw some kids playing in the fountain, you know, in the fountain. They don't supposed to, but they put their feet in the fountain. And I was watching them play in the fountain out front while I watched the front doors. I said, God, I said, those kids today, they're going to go home. And I said, the little guy will probably have liver and onions and gravy and potatoes, and he'll probably nibble off the potatoes a little bit and eat off the liver. And I said, my family sure would love to have what he had left over. And just, I guess I must have been getting delirious. I decided, maybe I'll call him and take a chance. I told the boy, I said, come here. I said, hey, come here. He looked at me. I guess his mom said, don't talk to strangers. But here I was beckoning at him from my little post in front of the seminary. And I said, listen, when you go home today and your mom and dad and you and your family, y'all, after you eat, so tell your mom to lick all of the scraps in a plastic bag. I knew they probably lived down in the seminary property somewhere. I said, rake all the scraps in the seminary in a bag. And tomorrow when you come to play here, tell them to put it in the refrigerator. And when you come here, bring it here and give it to me. And that little boy disappeared and he didn't play in front of this place for months. I guess it scared him to death. I don't blame him. But that turned out to be Dr. Tejan's son, who really never knew about that whole incident, never understood it until he got a lot bigger. But all these guys that used to be here, the guys who used to walk this place, Jim Fritchie, one of the students at this seminary, gave me my first food. He was kind of working a little extra on the campus and making beds and doing some other things along with us. And he looked at me one day as he passed the front of this library and he said, Otis, how you doing today? I said, I'm doing fine, just starving to death. He said, you really hungry? And after the ninth day, Jim Fritchie went home to his wife and where his wife and he lived, close to this campus, and put me in his car and took me back to the basement of where my wife and I were living in this abandoned house down on Cousin Avenue. He gave us some food, which my wife gobbled. I mean, I had wondered if the baby inside of her was going to be dead because I had been feeling moving too much after we had been without food for near 9 days. But then Jim Fitcher looked at where we were living, and he said, I'm not going to handle this, man. I'm going to do something. And he got us moved into the president of the students down at the bottom of Lower Hall. It's a room down there. He brought us from there to that room down there. And it was my first home in St. Louis, right here on this campus. And I worked for th- 3 years as a janitor here. And then afternoon, I would hustle food to feed folks around me. And I eventually moved into North St. Louis next to St. Paul's Lutheran Church, where I'm a member right now. And I would hustle food in the afternoon. And when I would hustle food, people would come there next door to the church to be waiting on me when I got off from my work. And an agency, Lutheran Family and Children's Services, spotted what I was doing and asked me if I would take a position as an outreach worker for them out in the neighborhood, and asked me to retire my buffing machine and my Windex. And I want to tell you, I love my buffing machine. If you don't believe I loved it all, when I talk about it in the Chicago Tribune in this past Thanksgiving issue, this was the picture that was in it in the Chicago Tribune. And right in the middle of that story, they talked about me and Concordia Seminary. Because this place I have a fantastic love for this place and the students who are here, because it was a student like one of you who found me, who made me a Lutheran. I always think that this is the place. When I was here, I was totally, totally gratified to see the place where the pastors who took care of me when I was out there in Birmingham, Alabama, and then Charlotte, North Carolina, and all over the world, those pastors who touched me, who brought Christ to me, where I was, they came from this place. And I was watching, I watched students, and I bumped under their feet when they practiced studying for exam. I watched them struggle. I watched them get married. I helped them move furniture in their apartments around Alamo and around all the other streets around the seminary. And even now, I drive up to the seminary, and I come past this building, and I stop, and I go, and I check the windows up there to see how they're taking care of my place. And I had made them promise that if I ever completed my work out there, that I could come back to this place, because this really is my home. Today out there, I'm going to be giving out about 4,000 pounds of food to families, because I found out that I have an attachment. The Lord really showed me he could get me in Concordia Seminary. A lot of folks out there ask me, they said, have you ever been to Concordia Seminary? I said, I've been to Concordia Seminary. Like no one ever has been to Concordia Seminary. And this is my place. This is my home. This is a place that has an attachment to me that showed that the Lord could get me here. He showed me he could get me here. And so I know where my place is. And so what I do is I go to St. Paul's Lutheran Church over there in North St. Louis. And I sit there and I listen. I've been an elder at St. Paul Lutheran Church. And I sit there and I listen at the gospel. And I listen at the music. I listen at the liturgy. And I let it fill me up. And then I said, now it's getting toward my part. You know, I start getting toward communion. And then the pastor said, now let that servant depart in peace. I said, it's getting there. It's getting there. And then the pastor gives the benediction. And when the pastor gives the benediction in my church, what I hear is, da-da-da-da-da-da. I said, now, Otis, I can take his gospel back out into my neighborhood and put that gospel into action and let that gospel live all this week long till I can get back into that church and get choiced up all over again. So I see that's where the Lord wanted me to be. That's exactly where he wanted me to be. And I feel so good that today some people would know that Jesus loves them, because I'm going to give them food. I'm going to give them water. I'm going to give them blankets. The other day I gave away 1,000 blankets in one day. I'm going to give away a couple of tons of firewood at my place today. And folks will know that this is the church. They're going to know that this is the gospel that our church has preached. And this is the church, how it looks after the benediction. That's what I call our church, the gospel after the benediction. And the excitement of being in the church is still brand new every day, because I look at people who look at my wood pile and who I give a box of food, and they said, praise the Lord. Now, if I could get them to know that the Lord is alive, that he still cares about them through me, then right on, that's exactly what needs to happen. And so those folks who are studying here right now, I'm always interested in looking at their faces and wondering how many Otises they're going to touch out there, because you are. You're going to find us. The janitors, the maids, the bartenders, the guys out there just waiting on the message that you got for them. I don't think that my pastor ever realized that the gospel that he preached at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Birmingham was going to end up looking like this. I mean, you look at me. I mean, Right now, they have to be totally shocked. As a matter of fact, just to show you how bizarre it all is, yesterday the guys were at my place. They're getting ready to run a story in the National Enquirer about my work. And the guys were out there yesterday with the cameras again. Now, they had been there once, and they had taken my pictures for the feature they're going to do in the National Enquirer. And they took them in these clothes. And then a guy wrote, called me from the National Enquirer and said, "We just can't handle this." Said, "We got 7 million readers, and they're going to think they cannot handle your clothes." Said, "Do you have any clothes that look normal?" I thought about my uniform from Concordia. You know, I had a uniform when I worked here. I thought about that. I don't have no clothes that look like normal clothes. So I had to go to Kmart to buy. He said, "Well, do the Bill Cosby look." And so I had to ask my kids. I have seven children. I have five boys and two girls. One of the boys was born while I was here. And in the school newspaper, they printed his name because his name was on the front of the Globe Democrat. His name is Otis Wood, and all my boys are named Otis Wood, all five of them. And then I have a daughter named Bridget and a daughter named Regina. But that one boy that was born at when I was here was really spectacular because he has 52 names. And his name was in your school newspaper. In the seminar, guess what the name of that paper was then? Seminar? It was a little newspaper. I had poetry even in the school newspaper that was here. And the people didn't know that Otis Wood, that poet was also the giant, and they didn't even know that when I was here. But his name is Otis Leandre Arnaldo Arthur Aubrey Benedicto Bennett Charlie Cleopatra Calvin David Delingio Eddie Ernest Everett Frank Foster Gregory Jerome Homer Herman Henry Ivan James Warren Jim Kevin Locke Lance Laverne Marshall Matthew Naaman O'Brien Patrick Paul Philip Quincy Robbie, Robert, Richard, Sim, Samuel, Tommy, Eula, Brenner, Willie, Ictus, Eulop, Zenith, Woodard. And that's his given name. When Pastor Roger Holland, who was at St. Paul Lutheran Church when he was born, with Jim Fritchie, who is a graduate who is now in Canada, who is his godfather, when the pastor went to baptize him, the pastor then warned the congregation. And there he was in front of St. Paul Lutheran Church. He's holding my baby. And he said, "I baptize you, Otis Leandre Arnaldo Arthur Aubrey Benedict." By the time he got the 15th name out, the urchins had started moving forward. I thought they were going to grab him. They thought he went crazy. he stopped and said, "I didn't warn you, but this baby has a particularly interesting name." But he was baptized there at St. Paul Lutheran Church. The work that I do in my neighborhood is real intense. Since I've been trying to get the gospel out into my neighborhood, real exciting things have happened. I've been shot twice in my neighborhood, intervening between people who are having family disturbances. I've delivered two babies in my office. Right now I have 40 girls who are pregnant, living out on the street, who are living in my place because I'm pro-life. And I figured that it's easy to say you're pro-life. The gospel, that old gospel that I got from St. Paul Lutheran Church gave me the value of life, and I had heard that there were girls sleeping on the street and who were making decisions about their babies because they didn't have nowhere to go. So I used some of my salary to buy some houses and to set up some houses so some girls would have places to stay while they're going through their pregnancy. And right now I have 40 girls. I've been in the delivery room 36 times since last September with girls who come through my little shelter program for pregnancy. I've been trying to get the gospel out into my neighborhood. Real exciting things have happened to me. I've been shot twice in my neighborhood, intervening between people who are having family disturbances. I've delivered two babies in my office. Right now I have 40 girls who are pregnant, living out on the street, who are living in my place because I'm pro-life. And I figured that it's easy to say you're pro-life. The gospel, that old gospel that I got from St. Paul Lutheran Church, gave me the value of life. And I had heard that there were girls sleeping on the street and who were making decisions about their babies because they didn't have nowhere to go. So I used some of my salary to buy some houses and to set up some houses so some girls would have places to stay while they're going through their pregnancy. And right now I have 40 girls. I've been in delivery room 36 times since last September. With girls who come through my little shelter program for pregnant girls. And I watch babies born. And when I stand there and I watch them, I have a little ceremony that I do. I've been at St. Mary's a lot. Because they let my girls come and deliver babies free there. But I sat there, and then I let the baby be born, and then I hold the baby for a few minutes, and then I give the baby back to the doctor, and then I throw up. It's really an I'm still the janitor from Concordia Seminary. And maybe if there's a lesson in all of this and our message that the Lord has is that the Lord uses us all. And that even the folks that you folks go out and be shepherds to will one day reach out because you touched them to somebody else. And you're coming out, and your being here is important. It's so important. I know how hard it is here because I talk to studying students who are doing the papers, who are studying their Greek, and who are having tough times. And I look at them and I think to myself, maybe I wouldn't have made it through here if I got here. But at the same time, you're here, and you folks are God are going to go out into the world. You're going to take the gospel. And we want to hear you. We want to hear you. If I hope that when you look at me and look at the janitors at this place, that you can know that we're all one family. When I was here, I thought that my work was important because I thought that as we all at this seminary tried to get folks prepared to go out in the world, I was a part of it because I kept the place clean and I cleaned the bathroom and made it comfortable for those as they tried to get on their way. Well, I've talked a long time. I decided maybe a song. Can I do you a song?
Yes.
I need the song for me. I've had a tough day today. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine. Any questions you'd like to ask me? I got to tell you about these beads, all right? You see, when I went into the Marine Corps, I blame this all on the United States Marines. When I went into the Marine Corps, I decided that I like being in the uniform in the morning. It got you up. It told you what you were about. It got you on your way. And it gave you a sense that you were on duty when you were wearing your uniform. And I would get up in the morning and I would say, let me do all this work. You're rough. You're tough. You're a Marine. If someone gave you an order to, you'd walk right through a wall. That's the way Marines feel. After I got out of the Marine Corps and decided to see what a tough Christian could do out there in the world, I decided I folded up all of my uniforms and took them down to Birmingham, Alabama. And my mother has a cedar chest with all my uniforms in it with a picture of me with a bald head on the top. After I pulled off my uniform, I decided that I needed something that told people that I was on duty, that I was about a special work. And this morning, when I got up this morning, I put on my real sophisticated beats because I'm still doing some work with the media. I'm supposed to go to Chicago and pass out, be on Today Show, the Morning America stuff, and pass out some awards in Chicago next week. My birthday is also coming up real soon. And I'm helping them make a movie, ABC make a movie about homeless people. And so I put on my sophisticated beats. I put on these beats because I was coming to see you. These are called my celebration beads. Whenever something real special is getting ready to happen to me, they know that I wear these red beads. And everybody in my neighborhood knew that I was going to be doing something special today. So I put on these beads for you. I put on these beads because some kids in Canada, some Lutherans in Canada, had told me that anytime I'm doing special work that has a little celebration connected to it, and that's what I call this coming to see you, to wear these beads, and so I'm wearing these beads for you also. This is kind of my work fun beads at the same time. These are my truck driving beads. Whenever I put on these beads, that means I'm driving the truck. And folks know that I'm driving the truck when I wear these beads. And these beads are my hope beads. They come from Hope Lutheran Church over in South St. Louis. And the kids said at any time you're being hopeful about things and prayerful about things, to wear these beads. And so I put on these beads today, because I'm getting ready to go into a cold weekend again. My firewood has always been my big challenge, to get enough firewood. I have about 400 families a day who have to come to get my firewood. So I'm praying that I can have enough heating material that nobody won't set themselves on fire trying to keep warm with what I give them, because sometimes they can abuse it. For the last 2 years, I haven't had one fatality connected with my wood pile and my beads. And so I'm wearing my prayer beads, my hope beads, hoping that I can get through this weekend again. They said it's supposed to have snow for Sunday. This shirt came from Kearney, Nebraska. And some ladies in Kearney, Nebraska gave me these beads because of this shirt. They made about 10 shirts. They had a contest to see who could make the best one for me to wear in the wintertime. They made their husbands wear them one day around Kearney, Nebraska. So when I got ready to dress this morning, I looked at myself in the mirror. I said, let me do this work. You're rough, you're tough, you're a Christian. And the day you're going to see tons of people who are hungry and cold and homeless, and the day you're going to be tired and you're going to be frustrated, you're going to even get cold being outdoors all day, but you're going to be on duty. And the folks in your neighborhood are going to be able to spot it instantly that you're ready to do the work that they ask of you. And so these clothes really say to the folks in my neighborhood that I'm on duty and ready to work. In the neighborhood where I live, you'll know that these clothes are very serious. Folks get very concerned if they see me dressing any other way. I had to dress for a photographer for the inquiry yesterday, and a lot of people stopped by and asked me what happened. They were worried that I wasn't on duty. But I changed immediately back in these clothes and sent my two shirts that I took the picture in to Kearney, Nebraska, to the ladies who made me this shirt so they could see this shirt when it comes out, the other shirt when it comes out in the inquiry, what I had to put on. But these are my work clothes. And folks who know it know that I'm on duty. You know, I'm ready to do my work. And I want to say that you folks, I hope you folks will never have to dress like this. Some of you will dress like this on the inside, because I think that what happens with a person when they really receive Jesus and have Jesus inside of them, ready to reach out there to the world, I think that each one of them inside is probably dressed kind of like this. There's a little prison inside of me dressed just like this, just running around trying to get loose. But you turning her loose. I guess that I'm not a specialist in theology. I probably look at, I used to dust off the shelves and look at all the Greek words and the Latin words, and I'm very confused about it. But I really just rubbing close to the books seem like they have a good value, being here and being among this place where the gospel was looked at and searched and where the arguments reigned fiercely in rooms like this of students who were trying to get that gospel clear enough to take it out in the world. Well, I pray for you to get the message clear enough that even a janitor can understand. Because really, they got to me. I have enough understanding to know that Jesus loves me and that whatever I do to anybody else out there, I just as well be doing it to Jesus Christ himself. I think that's a heavy little piece to know. And as I get older, I'm going to be 50 years old this summer tonight. I'm learning more and more every day. And it's people like you who will be out there to make sure that I keep the gospel in my ear and keep pounding and working with it so that I can better interpret it into the work that I do out there. I want to thank you for letting me be here. I always keep my ukulele warm at my place, so you come out our same thing too.
Yeah. I wonder if we can get our own Otis Porter down.
Listen, they are. You call my house. I'll let you get you in touch with Miss. There's a lady down in Perryville, Missouri. I helped a lady once in Perryville who moved to Perryville, Missouri. A German lady, her name was Audience. And the rumor about a doll like this was circulating around the city. They said a lady was down there making a doll that looked strangely like Otis Woodard. And she was passing around and telling the story about our meeting and caring about each other. And then a Lutheran pastor from Cape Girardeau went and kidnapped one of the dolls. And it started the spread of these dolls all over the United States. When I went to Lewistown, Pennsylvania, at a church there, two people at that church had a doll that looked like this. So they are everywhere. So you call my house, I'll get you in touch with Miss Audience. Miss Audience will be glad to get you in touch with one of these dolls, okay? So thank you, and God bless you. Pray for me, and I will pray for you. Thank you very much.